This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, what's happening, everybody? It is a Friday morning. It's very, very exciting. There's lots and lots of rain. People are talking about that, and when you talk about the weather, it's usually boring. So it's usually a sign that you need to move on to other topics of conversation. We've got lots of those for you to get into this morning and lots of things that we think you ought to know about. Mubs has got some news for you. We'll also later on get to meet the guys, the family behind Sasfin, which is one of the few family-owned banks in the world. I think it's only one of two. Stand to be corrected, but we will speak to Roland and Michael Sassoon, who are the second and third generation of that bank. And it's incredible. I didn't understand any of this until I met them not so long ago. And they're launching something new and exciting, which we'll talk to you about a little bit later as well. But what an interesting story. And I had no idea that this, and it's a proudly South African business. It's something that I think you'll be very interested in hearing the story of. So that's Sasfin, and we'll be talking to Roland and to Michael later on about the story of Sasfin and their own story, a family-owned bank. Sounds incredible, right?
Man.
Yeah. We'll find out all about that. First things first, you want to get into some news?
Yeah, okay, sure, let's do it.
Okay.
So, all right, let's begin with this. Toys R Us. Shame. They're having a tough time, right? Because they declared bankruptcy, they filed for liquidation, they're shutting down 735 of their stores. 33,000 workers are now panicking because it means that they're going to be without jobs. And according to Toys R Us, millennials are to blame for the situation that they now find themselves in. Yes, Sia, we're looking at you.
Really?
Millennials are mostly rated as those born between 1980 and 1997. The problem is, none of you idiots are having children. Are having children quickly enough to create the target market for Toys R Us. Yes.
Oh, no. So we've got to get to work, everybody.
Oof, I don't know about that. And what scientists call the demographic time bomb, they noted that fertility rates, and lowered by the increasing lifespan, millennials are prolonging starting families, unlike the baby boomers, which means that there just aren't as many children to go around.
So Toys R Us are upset about this?
Well, Toys R Us, you know, they're being asked why they now find themselves in this situation, and they're saying that this is one of the reasons, is because of this demographic time bomb. In a report by Business Insider, Toys R Us are also noting that the decline in sales is also attributed to online stores.
Yeah, you've got to have some chutzpah to tell people that the reason that your company isn't working is because they're not making enough children. Well, I mean, what a cheek. What, do you think every kid in the world has one of your dumb toys?
Online stores and online games. That probably accounts for the bigger portion of the reason why they are now struggling. Now, various lenders, including JP Morgan, have agreed to infuse Toys R Us more than $3 billion.
What?
Which will immediately improve the company's financial health.
You better believe it.
But yeah, shame. It's tough. But you know what, guys? Because I have nephews and a niece.
Mm-hmm.
These toys aren't cheap, eh?
No, they're expensive.
Your?
I have two nephews. Look, they're so spoiled, these two kids. I don't even know what to get them anymore because their parents have already got them everything.
Everything.
You also got that problem?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not just if they're into Iron Man. It's not just the Iron Man costume. There are so many, Iron Man glove.
What a ridiculous argument from Toys R Us. How dare they? Do they think we're complete ignoramuses?
Please.
I mean, first of all, one toy doesn't go to one child. One child doesn't only have one toy. So why don't you sell those millennials who have one kid or who haven't yet got a kid and they're going to have just one? Why don't you sell them 20 toys each?
Ugh.
Dummies. Who's running that company?
Well,
the guys who ran Eskom?
Well, the guy who used to run their company has just died, and now they're using that even more to guilt trip us.
What?
Yes.
What is this? Tell me what you mean.
The founder of Toys R Us has now just died. When was it? A couple of days ago. Thursday. Yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And
are you going to bury him in a Lego casket?
Sure.
I mean, okay. If they didn't, they just are missing out on an opportunity.
I hope he's going to have a tombstone with a Barbie on it.
Now I've been seeing a few people on social media say, look at what has happened. He couldn't stomach the news that Toys R Us is failing.
No, this is mad. Please. All right, now hang on.
He was old.
Okay, so what happened to him? He was just chilling and then he sat in his chair one day and didn't get up?
All that has been revealed thus far is that he died in Manhattan.
Okay, so he died all right. I mean,
and he was 94 years old. What did you expect?
Did he own the property he died in? Because if you own property in Manhattan, you're not living too terrible a life.
Look, he's the founder of Toys R Us.
Yeah, I'm sure he did okay.
So back, I think he did well.
Back in 1987,
Good for him.
He was the number one highest paid executive, earning more than $60 million.
Well, good for him.
We aren't feeling bad for him here at all.
No, I don't feel bad for him, but I also don't begrudge him this. He did well.
Yeah, in August 2013, he sold his duplex in Manhattan for $21 million. So he was fine. He was just old. I don't think this had anything to do with the fact that Toys R Us is going through what they're going through.
No, I don't think so either.
Toys R Us, you're not going to get into people's bedrooms. We are now not going to fornicate just for you.
Well, there's an interesting point of view from Gary Vaynerchuk about why Toys R Us is struggling. Listen to this.
Interesting times in the retail landscape. Let me just talk to you guys about why Toys R Us filing Chapter 11 matters. Toys R Us did two things over the last couple decades that make no sense. One, very early in the 2000s, they outsourced themselves to Amazon. I don't know if a lot of you kids know this. Maybe you could pull a headline clip. I don't remember, maybe 2001, 2. The headline would probably say Toys R Us using Amazon for fulfillment. They didn't believe in the internet 17 years ago, so they let Amazon do their fulfillment, which started people getting used to buying toys on the internet through an Amazon world instead of a Toys R Us world. But most importantly, they just didn't innovate. You know, and when you don't innovate, you die. Like, when you don't change, you die. The world passes you by, and that's ultimately what is their issue, right? They didn't change their stores into, you know, American Girl experiences. Like, you could have made Toys R Us 3 years ago could have created the national Lego championships. And everybody would be, there was a million, they could have made slime centers. They could be killing it right now with their locations, but no, they choose to just like sell toys out of it. And none of you want to go there. First of all, you're going to go to Walmart and pick it up for less money anyway, while you pick up your groceries and anything else. And if you even want to leave home, and you don't, and so you'll go to Amazon and do it that way, or buy it from somebody's YouTube channel link or, you know, Instagram account. It's the best example right now of like how in trouble everybody is if they rest on their laurels. You know, if Toys R Us, the dominant niche retail leader of a humongous multi-billion-dollar category, is finished, what do you think is going to happen over the next 6 years? In every category. So retailers, media companies, entrepreneurs, influencers, when there's a million influencers every day popping up, supply and demand, lack of innovation, you gotta be different. This is why I recall a couple episodes ago, go deep into voice. Most people aren't playing there yet. Stay alive, be there when the world comes to you. Innovate or die.
Innovate or die, he says. That's the whole problem. So Toys R Us, there he goes explaining the whole thing to you. So Toys R Us are in trouble because they didn't innovate quickly enough, and they lost from being the market leader to having to declare bankruptcy. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Mm.
Speaking of innovate or die, you know, Amazon right now are just kicking everyone's ass, right?
Oh, yeah. Jeff Bezos. You know this rain that we've got coming down now?
Yeah.
That's because Jeff Bezos has, he's got so much money that he's displaced a whole lot of water. And the water has now got to come out of the sky and fall somewhere else.
So because Amazon are doing so well, it's putting pressure on other companies to try and innovate, which is exactly what that guy was talking about. So have a listen to what Google and YouTube are doing, or at least trying to do. So Google are apparently making a push to turn product searches into cash. Do you remember when Amazon bought Whole Foods and then everybody was like, what the hell is going on here? And then it was later revealed that, you know, you can walk into the Amazon store, collect all the items that you want to purchase, and you walk out, no queues, no none of that.
Right.
So now, Alphabet Inc.'s Google routinely fields product queries from millions of shoppers, and they now want to take a cut of their purchases too. So the technology company is teaming up with retailers including Target, Walmart, Home Depot, Costco, Under a new program, retailers can list their product searches on Google Search, as well as on the Google Express shopping service, and then Google Assistant on mobile phones and voice devices. In exchange for Google listings and linking to retailer loyalty programs, the retailers will then pay Google a piece of each purchase, which is different from payments that retailers make to place ads on Google platforms.
What?
What?
I don't understand any of what does that mean?
So Google's pitch to retailers is a better chance to influence shoppers' purchasing decisions. It is a move that is likely to help them compete with their rival Amazon.
All right.
Google hopes that the program will help retailers capture more purchases on desktop, cell phones, and smart home devices with voice search, which is the next frontier for e-commerce.
You see that Lizard King Mark Zuckerberg, he lost like $5 to $10 billion of his value because of his company shares yesterday. Facebook shares went plummeted down again, another 5 or 6% yesterday.
Yeah.
If you own Facebook, you rascal. Spying on people for a living. Don't you have any shame? If you own Facebook shares, that's the bad news, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Shame. He did.
So, Facebook. No, he did apologize, but who believes him?
Come on.
Yeah,
who believes him?
I just scrolled past his CNN interview, and he looked quite solemn and, just a matter of fact.
He's the least authentic human being that ever was.
Well, he's a lizard.
That's right. He's not a human. Yes.
Is there? Never mind. I shouldn't even bother asking this question. Not even 1% of you that thinks. He's a good person.
No.
Okay.
I don't believe there's anything good. I don't believe Mark Zuckerberg has ever done anything good out of the kindness of his heart for anyone.
So
ever.
Did you watch the movie The Social Network?
Yes. He even stole the whole idea of Facebook from those two rich kids.
So you watched that and you went, all just factually incorrect.
It was propaganda, man. What are you, stupid? Propaganda.
Perhaps I am then the Lizard King.
Well, I think we should ask the Von Winklevoss.
The Winklevoss brothers.
Those two. Wow. I mean, if there's anybody who hates Mark Zuckerberg the most, it's those two.
Well, now we're all starting to see why.
Yeah. The signs were there all along. We just, we got swept up in the...
Yeah, we chose to ignore them.
We got swept up in the movie hype.
Like, Facebook's so wonderful, I can wish my friends in America happy birthday.
Mm. And we all, and they make these great videos for us. Mm. Meanwhile,
they're mining your data in the background. Handing it over to Donald Trump's campaign, for God's sake. Imagine. Anyway. And then they regulate your free speech. I don't know if you've noticed, but on the few occasions where I do share something on Facebook now, it doesn't reach all the people it used to. Like, if you've got 100 friends, it'll reach 20 of them now. Because you're not paying Facebook. The people who pay Facebook, their messages go far and wide.
Mm.
I used to post something, and I'd have 500 friends either like it or comment it. And it's not because the stuff's got boring. It's got more interesting. But now it gets to less people. I don't think we need this Facebook thing. I mean, I was talking to Toby Shapshak the other day. We had lunch last week, and he said to me he's deleted Facebook off his phone. He still has Facebook, but he checks it, once every 2 weeks, and it's on the laptop. He doesn't use his phone for Facebook. And he said his life is so much better. It's so much less bombarded with notifications every day. This one likes your picture, and that one commented on your status, and you don't need that stuff. Unhitch your wagon.
Yeah.
There's better stuff to be doing. All right, speaking of better stuff to be doing, you can catch Chance the Rapper along with Shane Eagle, Nadia Nakai, and Frank Casino at the Castle Light Unlocks concert, the Ticket Pro Dome in Joburg, on the 30th of April. Now remember, the next day is a public holiday, so there is no reason to miss out. That's at the end of the month of April. Put it in your diary now. Get your tickets at CompuTicket for the Castle Light Unlocks concert. You don't want to miss the Castle Light Unlocks exclusive. And don't forget to catch O'Neill and the O'Neill Africa Experience on cliffcentral.com. You can download previous podcasts. They include live performances from Lady Zamar and Prime Circle, among others. Download it now at cliffcentral.com.
Okay. Now, YouTube this week quietly introduced tighter restrictions on videos involving guns.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, Americans and their problems. Becoming the latest battleground in the U.S. gun control debate, YouTube are banning videos that promote or link to websites selling firearms as well as accessories. This includes bump stocks, which allow a semi-automatic rifle to fire faster. Additionally, YouTube say they're going to prohibit videos with instructions on how to assemble firearms. The video site has faced intense criticism for hosting videos about guns, bombs, and other deadly weapons. And I suppose the criticism and the pressure has now gotten to them. So they've decided, okay, we will start introducing these tighter restrictions.
Everybody goes for the lowest hanging fruit on this thing. Everybody's like, well, let's stop people from buying them. Why do people want to buy these things? That's what we've got to address. Like, what is it about people that makes them want to go and buy an automatic weapon? Because there's, you can kill the marketplace. You can make it more difficult for people to get these guns. That's not going to stop someone who wants one of these guns. You can make it as hard as you like. I mean, in this country, for example, we've got quite strict gun laws, but it seems to me the criminals have no shortage of guns.
Yeah,
so
well,
all that happens is you end up making law-abiding, sensible, sane people have to jump through more hoops for something that they're not going to endanger the public with. But for bad people, it makes no difference. You really think that some nutcase who's going to walk into a school and shoot it up isn't just going to take someone else's firearm if he can't find his own? Isn't going to steal one? Isn't going to do some black market trading to get hold of one? If someone's got evil intentions, why are you going about finding the legal channels to make it harder for them? They don't use the legal channels.
What if the answer to your question is as simple as they're buying these guns because they are that readily available? Because they're that easy to get.
I don't believe. I mean, you know, knives are readily available. You don't read about knife crime escalating.
So then why do
Shambok crime? You could buy Shamboks.
So then why do they have this gun problem in that part of the world?
That's what I'm saying. Address the root cause here. Don't try and make the marketplace complicated. I don't understand this gun thing. I really don't. I don't get it. Let's go to Dr. Jonathan Witt. He's on the line. He wants to talk about this. Hey, Dr. Witt, what's up?
Morning, Gareth and team. How are you?
Have you pulled another all-night shift?
Oh, no. Okay. No, not last night, thank goodness.
Just checking.
Yeah. This gun issue.
Yeah.
You discussed it the other day. I just wanted to try to correct some inaccuracies. I mean, firstly, you spoke about automatic weapons. Automatic weapons have been banned in the United States since 1984. So why
does that keep coming up then? Who's making this shit up? Who's talking nonsense in the media about this?
Well, I don't know. It's a polarized debate, obviously, and people get quite emotional about it. And I think there's a lot of misinformation. The reality is people that don't like guns often don't know very much about guns. And the argument against automatic weapons, for example, is a moot point, actually, because they are, in fact, banned. If you want to talk about semi-automatic weapons, well, almost all weapons, pretty much, except for some rifles, are not semi-automatic. Semi-automatic just means that you pull the trigger once, you let go of the trigger, one round gets fired and another one comes up into the chamber. Most weapons do that these days.
Right.
And have for quite a while now.
Right. We're not loading muskets.
No, exactly. You're not loading a musket and you're not loading a single round. So at a time. I mean, even a revolver technically is semi-automatic in a sense, because once you shoot one round, another round is ready to go.
What is the story about these assault rifles where you can – these bump stocks? What's that all about?
Well, a bump stock just – I mean, the bump stock just makes a round come up into the chamber quicker. It uses the recoil of the weapon to do that. But they're pretty uncommon, firstly. Secondly, they haven't actually been used in any major crimes in the U.S. So, you know, these arguments around bump stocks are quite irrelevant, actually. And there were some, that shooting, that mass shooting in Las Vegas, there was something said about bump stocks being used there, but we know very little about that shooting, in fact. I mean, we know lots about the shooting at the school, and we know lots about all kinds of other incidents that have happened. That shooting, very little has actually been released. So we barely have any footage. We know nothing about the shooter. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite interesting how little is known about what is the largest mass shooting in the United States history.
Right.
But just on the point of shootings is that they're all – the volume of shooting is coming down. So the argument that gun crime is getting worse, it is in some cities, for example, getting worse. Chicago has a serious problem with gun crime. But overall in the U.S., gun deaths are down and decreasing and have been for decades, as are school shootings, by the way.
So,
you know, it's not that anyone's saying they should happen, but
all right,
the
reality so if these are in decline,
down.
I mean, is it sensationalism? And because it's such a horrific thing and it happens, and you say it's happening less and less, not more and more.
Well, everything has to be politics now, Gareth. You know, the reality is that the Parkland shooting, everybody knows about, and everybody knows about certain of the kids. I mean, there's one kid by the name of David Hogg that CNN has had on the network probably 20 or 30 times so far. He's the kind of guy who calls Dana Loesch from the NRA a dumb bitch, and he says things like this. It's very polarized. Everyone knows about the Parkland shooting, mm-hmm. but there was a shooting 2 days ago in Maryland where a kid arrived at school and started shooting at other kids, and there happened to be an armed security guard on site who realized what was going on within a couple of seconds, took out his weapon and shot the shooter dead.
Good.
You haven't heard about that.
No.
Because the problem is the politics are such that we hear about the shootings where everything goes horribly, where the truth is in Parklands, the reason why so many people died, it has nothing to do really with the gun and everything to do with the fact that the authorities didn't respond to, firstly, several warnings over years about this guy, and then the sheriff told his deputies not to enter the building. One guy stood outside the building for 4 minutes. An armed police officer stood outside the building for 4 minutes while the shooting went on. So the reality is that a lot of these things are politicized, and we can have the gun debate, absolutely, but we should have a level-headed gun debate rather than one that basically just turns around and says, let's take away all the guns based on these, as I say, facts that aren't facts, and a lot of inaccuracies in what people understand about weapons.
Why is this a problem unique to Americans? What the hell is wrong with them?
Is it unique, Mavali? 19,000 people killed in South Africa last year, one of the highest murder rates. Not all of them by guns, fair enough, but a fair number. I don't think it's unique to America at all. I think it's a problem we think is unique to America. And I think all societies have gun issues. The reality is that Australia is often held up as a shining example of gun control. It is easier to control guns when you're a small island in the middle of, well, not a small island, they're a continent, but you're an island in the middle of the ocean. The reality is that even Australia is having issues with gun control. There are still millions of guns in Australia that were never handed in. And gangs in Australia, as Gareth alluded to, criminals don't follow laws. So there are plenty of gangs in Australia that still regularly have shootouts with each other. So, you know, the problem is that I don't think it's a specifically American problem. I think America does indeed have a problem. But if you look at stats of America in terms of gun deaths, there are other countries that compare just as well with America per capita, etc. It's not just an American problem. That said, Americans value their right to self-defense. There are 150 million guns or something like that in America, about 350 million people. So that's a lot of guns. And you're not going to solve this problem of gun violence by getting rid of guns, just simply because you need to accept that it's an impossibility to get rid of people's guns.
So what I'm hearing is then they should rather just get rid of the people. Gotcha. I am all for it. I agree.
Yeah, there's the nihilist.
Yep.
All right, thanks. Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers. Thanks, cool. guys.
There's Dr. Jonathan Witt. Some useful info. See, it does help to get into the facts here and to not rely on what you read in the surface, because too many people have an agenda when they're, whether their story is to advance the cause of you know, people who want to defend themselves, or whether it's to advance the cause of people who want to shut down the right of people to protect themselves. It really depends on what side of the fence you're on. So you got to get into the detail here. All right, what else is there?
Well, Stormy Daniels at this point. Because
Stormy Daniels, of course, is the porn star who supposedly slept with Donald Trump and then broke her non-disclosure agreement.
And now she's being sued.
But out with the old, in with the new. Because now a former Playboy model, Karen McDougal, is claiming to have had a 10-month affair with the U.S. President Donald Trump starting in 2006, which, if you look at the timeline, is just a little after the First Lady Melania gave birth to their son, Barron. So this is now, this new Karen is now doing the interview rounds, and she was on CNN with Anderson Cooper just yesterday, and she spoke about the fact that Trump used to tell her all the time that he was in love with her, and that she actually thought this would lead to marriage. So
what?
No.
Yes.
No.
The Playboy model believed in her heart that Trump would leave Melania for her. She says that they met at the Playboy mansion.
Wow. That's a great start.
What a romantic story. While Trump was filming The Celebrity Apprentice, and she says that I was attracted to him. He's a nice looking man. That's a lie, girl. You were looking at his money and you know who he is. Trump ain't nice looking.
No, he definitely isn't.
And she says that I liked his charisma, and the only reason she's now speaking out.
You liked his money.
Yes.
Dumb Playboy model.
What? Guys. I need to understand the allure with attention. What does it do for people?
Well, on top of doing the interview round, she's also suing the National Enquirer, which was the first to release something around the story. So she just wants the validation of attention. You're asking, what is it about attention? It's the fact that people care about me.
But they don't.
Well, for 2 seconds they do. We're talking about
it.
No, we don't. We're gawking and staring at you, possibly making jokes about you, laughing at you, judging you. We don't care about you.
But rather you say something than say nothing at all.
I don't know.
It's what you're alluding to here, like attention seeking. It's the least attractive human characteristic. Mm. If you're in a room and there's someone in the room who's desperate for attention and they just keep on, like, doing things that get them attention, you want them out of the room. That's the kind of people we're talking about. And don't let me for a minute give you pause to reflect on Donald Trump not being an attention seeker, because we know he's got that as well.
Mm.
But these people climbing out of the woodwork now, saying, "Oh, Donald Trump made a pass on, you know, back in the Playboy mansion in the 1980s." Get over yourself. You are irrelevant.
That's it.
You're irrelevant.
Then you want to be relevant.
I know, so you make stuff up or
you
dredge up some old story.
You were a Playboy model. Did you not get enough attention? Come on.
But you see, this is the problem with attention. You get a little bit and you want some more. It's a drug.
I love how...
You don't get full. It's not like a battery when you charge your phone and it's at 100%. It doesn't need any more. The attention battery keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The more you get, the more you need.
Well, in her legal statement, though, she says, "I just want the opportunity to set the record straight and move on with my life."
Like, okay. Who was stopping you? Who's been in your... Yeah, you know, you have to have an enormous amount of self-absorption going on for you to imagine that you clearing the air, in inverted commas, purging yourself of this secret that somehow... This is because other people haven't let you get on with your life. Nobody cares. You're going to go back to that life, and it'll be exactly like it was before this story.
Has there ever been a president who's been surrounded by so much sex scandal?
Are you kidding? John F. Kennedy?
John F. Kennedy.
Were there tons of women?
Yes, tons of women. That whole Marilyn Monroe period.
Well, we just know of Marilyn singing to him.
No.
Happy birthday.
Good morning.
Oh, hello, Mr. President.
This is Ted Kennedy, remember?
Oh, you were never president.
I was never president. Shame. I was the only one of my brothers who never became president.
Yes, wow. Ted.
I'm here to clear the air.
Okay.
And to get on with my life.
Okay.
You know I'm dead.
Oh, well, shame. This is true.
Yes, I wanted to just make sure that everybody knew the truth about my brother, my brothers, first of all, John F. Kennedy, which we call Jack.
Yes.
And my other older brother, Bobby.
Yes.
Robert, we called him Bobby.
Right, so...
We didn't call any of our siblings by their actual names.
It's very confusing, Ted.
Yes.
Okay, so what do you want to clear up?
My brother banged a lot of Hollywood starlets.
Right, yes. Which brother now are you talking about?
Any of the, pick a number.
And while in office as well? That's quite something.
In the Oval Office, on top of the Oval Office, in the bathroom, in the passage, in the hall.
Okay.
In the cabinet room.
Yep. Mm.
He's really getting up in there.
He didn't want them here and there. He wanted them everywhere.
So you...
we had a quilt made for him in Massachusetts with that there in it.
What do you know about Marilyn, Ted? Because
why do you think Jack had a bad back?
Oh, that explains it.
Always humping away.
Oh, well, you know, we were told that was a medical condition.
Sure, a medical condition of too much sex.
Oh, okay.
And what
right.
What about you, Ted?
I had so many women.
Well, there you go.
Even though you didn't make it to the Oval Office?
You know, I drove a girl, called Mary Jo Kopechnik. I drove her home one night.
Yes, you were sober?
That doesn't matter.
I have a high tolerance.
So what happens along? What happened along this drive, Ted?
I went over a bridge.
Oh, shame.
But I didn't go over the bridge. I went off the bridge into the river.
And what happened to the girl?
I still haven't been to the car to check.
Oh.
And that was 40 years ago.
You just leave that scene. Mm-hmm.
Well, not everybody's perfect.
Ted, did you do any time behind bars for...
Oh, are you kidding? I'm a Kennedy.
Right. Okay.
Different rules apply to different people, honey.
This is true, Ted.
Yes.
Anyway, my brothers had a lot of women.
So, are you saying that the Kennedys rank in the first position when it comes to presidential sex scandals?
This Donald Trump is an amateur.
Right.
Oh.
My brother Jack.
Yeah.
Every single room.
Right.
In the White House.
Sure.
More than five times in each room.
And you did it.
A day.
And you did it without the Playboy Mansion, without the money.
Who needs that? Amateurs.
There we go.
So who's more of an amateur between Trump and Bill Clinton in the sex capades?
Bill Clinton has nothing on the Kennedys, and I don't want to talk about comparing him with Trump.
Why?
Because they're both also rans.
Ted, we appreciate your calls, as you know.
I have lots of time. Do you want to carry on talking?
No,
we don't.
Ted.
Sorry, Ted, we got to
go.
Thank you.
Why do you always leave us with him?
Because I don't have anything to say to Ted.
And isn't that something? The guy who didn't make it into the White House is calling Clinton and Trump also-rans.
Well, Bill Clinton, he had his fair share.
Well,
he didn't have Marilyn Monroe.
I think there was something glamorous about that.
Shame. Obama was so boring by comparison.
What a good guy. Obama was such a decent human being.
Did we hear anything from Bush? No sex scandals.
Well, he used to... Bush Sr. or Bush... George W. No, W
George
was...
George H. and George...
you see, W had become one of those reborn Christians. Now, usually, that means trouble. But in his case, it didn't.
He was very mean trouble.
He was very loyal. He was very loyal to Laura.
What about...
And then before that, George H.W. Bush, he used to pose for photographs with girls and he'd grab their backsides.
Yes, we remember that. What about Nixon?
Oh.
He was just a crook.
No one wanted to. Nixon was so busy stealing, he didn't have time for women.
He was just a crook.
Cheating and stealing. He was a crook. He was cheating. He was trying to stay in power forever.
Hmm.
and he was trying to build relations with China. He saw China as the next big thing, so he was right there. And he was trying to, you know what, Nixon was so unattractive.
Really?
Nixon was such an ugly man. Do you know that he went on TV? This is an interesting story a lot of people don't know. When he did the first ever televised debate against Kennedy, it was 1961, somewhere, 60, 61, somewhere around there. Kennedy was this good-looking young man. Women loved him. And he went up against this Richard Nixon, who looks like a puppet. And Richard Nixon grew facial hair faster than any person in the world. He had to shave, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, he had stubble.
No,
yes,
come
he was
on.
A, no, he was a monster.
He's Chewbacca.
So Kennedy and Nixon debated each other. And if you listened to it on the radio, you would think Nixon had been the winner. They did a survey, huge survey, thousands of people in America. If you'd heard it on the radio, you would have said Nixon was better, answered all the questions better, knew his way around things. But the people who watched on TV rated Nixon 1 out of 5 and Kennedy 5 out of 5. Just because he was better looking. Mostly women.
Sure.
Because Nixon was such a hideous monster. Isn't that interesting? And they say that's one of the reasons Kennedy won.
Because he was good looking.
Better looking. And
it's pretty privileged.
Didn't have that 5 o'clock shadow, and he wasn't sweating. Nixon was sweating a lot.
That's not a good look.
People have got to know.
Yep.
Whether or not I've shaved this morning. Well, I haven't. Now I've got a beard down to my toes.
Okay, that's it.
All right, let's get into something serious for a second. You know, we talk a lot of nonsense here, but we actually have important things to do. And I want to meet in the next couple of minutes Roland and Michael Sassoon of SASFIN. I'm interested in this because it's one of only, I think only two, but it could be 3 or 4, but it's very few banks in the world that are family-owned. They started it here in South Africa. In fact, their grandfather, that's Roland's grandfather, would have started it. And it's fascinating. It started in Norwood in Joburg in 1951. And by that time, the business evolved from textile importing to a small-scale trade and debtor financing company. It grew steadily in stature to see SASFIN become listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in 1987. To continue growing the business, SASFIN took the groundbreaking step of securitizing its equipment finance book in 1991. And remember, having been established in 1951 by Sydney Sassoon, it evolved into this bank that we know now, SASFIN Holdings Limited, a bank controlling company, and through all its subsidiaries, it is, and notably, of course, the bank, the group offers a range of comprehensive modular banking and finance services focused on the needs of the entrepreneur, corporate institution, and high net worth individual, my buddy. They have over 700 staff members throughout the offices in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, East London, Plettenberg Bay, Port Elizabeth, Pretoria, and Hong Kong, and we'll talk about something new that they've launched called Beyond in a moment or two. But for now, let's welcome Roland and Michael Sassoon. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Nice to meet you. I had no idea that this was such an exception to the rule in terms of financial institutions. There aren't a lot of beasts out there that look like SASFIN.
Yeah, we are different.
And a family-owned bank and a family-run bank. You ran it for a while. Now your son's running it.
Correct.
And before that, your father started the business. And obviously, he didn't start it as a bank, but that's an incredible story, 3 generations.
Yeah, look, when my father joined his father in textiles, and so we don't actually know when it all started.
So it could have been 5 or 6 generations, maybe, for all you know. That's an incredible story.
Yeah.
And it's a very South African story, too.
Well, yes. My father came to South Africa in about 47.
Okay.
After the war.
Right.
And he started this textile business in partnership with his brothers. He had 6 brothers.
Yes.
And he actually started in town. I heard you say Norwood.
We moved to Norwood
a lot later. We had a textile business with a warehouse and all the rest.
Uh-huh.
And I joined him at the age of 17, straight after school. But the textile business that we were in was in decline because in those days, South Africa was... protecting the local industry. They were always scared of sanctions. Zimbabwe or Rhodesia had fallen. A UDI had taken place, and South Africa was like next on the list as far as sanctions were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So the government put in huge tariff protection, quota protection, and it made the import of textiles, which was our business, impossible.
Right.
So we started looking at different things.
We were talking earlier about innovation and how if you don't innovate, you get left behind. I mean, that's people dancing on a moving carpet, so to speak.
Yes, yes. So that's what happened. So,
and isn't it interesting that the textile business hasn't really got very much better in South Africa, because obviously you can import for far less than you can make here in South Africa. And obviously a lot of people who are in and were in the textile business are struggling a little bit now.
Yeah, that's right. In those days, there was a huge textile industry.
Mm.
There was Frame, Good Hope Textiles, a whole lot of these textile manufacturing companies and clothing manufacturing companies that we serviced. And that whole industry has gone into huge decline. There's hardly any textiles made in South Africa. And the clothing industry itself is very small in South Africa. Everything's imported from China and the Far East and everywhere else.
If you look at the composition of the JSE, the number of clothing businesses there were and manufacturing clothing businesses and textile businesses listed kind of in the early 90s, there was a significant number. And now I think you'll be hard-pressed to find more than one or two.
So, Roland, I hear that you're full of all kinds of new ideas at Sasfin. In terms of you're the group chief executive, and then you're CEO.
Michael's the group chief. Executive.
Michael, you're the group chief executive, yes, and what are you doing now?
I'm.
What have you done now?
I'm in handover mode.
Okay.
So Michael started.
Well, you've been at the helm for how long now?
Well, as I say, I've been there since the age of 17, and I'm now 73. Look, I did take 10 years off to go and do an apprenticeship.
In
finance. So
where did you go?
Well, I joined different finance companies. Mm-hmm. I joined a company called Metropolitan that doesn't exist anymore. I joined a company called Trade and Industry that doesn't exist anymore.
Let's just clear this up in case you were not responsible for them not existing anymore.
Absolutely
you were just apprenticing.
I joined Barclays Bank.
Yes.
I spent a couple of years there. And
which in this country soon went.
The Barclays anymore. Bank and in South Africa, before Barclays had left South Africa. And then I rejoined my father, who in those days was just running a tiny little business.
Now, was this him saying to you, go out and learn, or was it something you wanted to do?
No, it was something I wanted to do. He wasn't very happy with me when I left him. He felt that I'd kind of abandoned him, but I'd never abandoned him, in fact, because I was moonlighting. I had these jobs and I was helping him at night. And then I met a young lady at Barclays Bank who I eventually married.
This is Esther.
No, his wife is Esther.
Your wife's
wife is Eva.
They've confused the hell out of this for me because they've called Michael here Roland and Roland Michael. That's why I'm confused.
Okay.
Jesus. All right, sorry. All right, so you met your wife. She was at Barclays.
And then We got married there, so we couldn't actually both work at Barclays. So she left and joined my father, and she helped him with his books and all the rest. She was a good bookkeeper. And then I eventually joined him as well.
But there's something about that, because you in business, there are only a few people you can trust. And really, this is why I suppose family businesses do, on the average, have an element of, you know, there's a kind of an openness about them. There's this, the fact that, I mean, you know, when you have your own son helping you out in the business, there's certain things you can ask him to do that you wouldn't ask a normal staff member to do.
Absolutely.
And there are things that you can trust each other with that you might not if it was a complete stranger or someone that you'd even been in business with for a few years.
Yeah. Blood is thicker than water.
It really is, right?
Yeah.
And when you develop a business from its origins, in this case, very different to where it is now, And you watch that evolution, and your family grows with that evolution. It's an interesting path to walk, particularly with, you know, generation after generation of a family shepherding that in the right direction.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I'm delighted to see Michael take over.
Right.
It's also a bit of a relief for me, to be honest. But it's a great thing to see that the formula is working, you know, and hopefully he'll carry on, and who knows what will happen in the future.
So what is it that makes SASFIN so different to so many other institutions that have a similar place in the economy to what you guys have?
Okay, well, look, there are a few things, but I would say perhaps from my perspective, I came in as a textile merchant. That was my origins. So I understood how a small entrepreneur thought and the frustrations that they had with banks. And we really went into this thing saying, look, here's a niche, because a small guy goes to see his bank manager. And in those days, that's how it worked. These days it doesn't work like that anymore.
Right.
Because you don't even see a bank manager anymore. Now you see a relationship manager who's a glorified messenger.
Yeah.
The decision's all made in some ivory tower, and you've really got no access to the people who make the decisions. In those old days, you did have access. You could go to the bank manager. You'd normally kind of walk in on your hands and knees and beg for assistance.
Well, these guys were tremendously powerful people once.
Yeah, and they were not entrepreneurial people. In fact, they were kind of anti the entrepreneur.
They were a bit bureaucratic.
Yes, and they almost looked down on the entrepreneur, you know. So it was quite a difficult relationship, the entrepreneur and the bank manager, and a lot of jokes about that. So we saw this, there was a gap, and we aimed to fill that gap. So we went about being the user-friendly bank for the entrepreneur, and that's still our culture very much. But of course, the business has changed a lot.
And how has South Africa changed under, the kind of the watchful eye of an institution like SASFIN, where you have to look out for these rule breakers, these entrepreneurs, these people who necessarily, because of the fact that they're not willing to, you know, go out there and just do a job, they want to start their own businesses, they want to get into parts of the economy that aren't exploited or underexploited. I mean, do you feel that this country is moving in the right direction in that respect? Do you feel that there are lots of opportunities that have been created? Do you feel that we have an entrepreneurial culture?
Yes, I do feel that there's an entrepreneurial culture. But I think what's happened is the time horizons have changed. Because in the old days, I feel, and maybe it's just because I myself am old, so maybe I'm kind of romanticizing it a bit, but I feel that the horizons were longer. You know, you'd think in terms of building up a business with a manufacturing business, employing lots of labor and as we said, making clothing or whatever it was, furniture, all those things.
It was a long game.
And I think that the whole thing has changed, because first of all, there's the question of globalization. Mm-hmm. So now you're competing with the whole world. In those days, we were very isolated, and particularly South Africa was very isolated because of sanctions, etc. So it almost benefited the entrepreneur to be isolated, because then he could really build something without having to worry, is China going to dump on us, or who's going to dump on us? Mm. And so I think with globalization, you've got to be much more opportunistic rather than have a long-term strategy. You know, you've got to kind of duck and dive with the dynamics of the market.
Well, the reason I ask is, and Michael, perhaps you have some opinion on this too, is that we hear this buzzword being dropped all over the place. Everyone wants to be an entrepreneur now. Everyone wants to start their own thing, whether it's a tech startup or something in manufacturing or anywhere else. And it sounds cool. It's hard work and it's very, very tough. And for the first couple of years, most of these businesses either don't get started, or they start losing money and hemorrhaging very badly in the first year and a half, or they struggle a little bit longer before they find their feet. Do you find that in South Africa at the moment there's a conducive atmosphere and environment for entrepreneurship?
Well, look, I think it's very difficult to be an entrepreneur in South Africa. The regulatory framework, the labor laws, the policies don't always support entrepreneurism. And, you know, with globalization, the competition is significant.
Which
Roland said. And the world's changing so fast. So many industries are being uprooted and being made redundant and changed. So you need to be very forward-looking. And a lot of entrepreneurism today needs to be supported by, I would say, strong tech, strong innovation from a tech perspective. So kind of old industries, you know, and we see it with our customers. Customers right. that are involved in these old industries, they are under pressure, especially that are very tied to SA Inc. But then there are some very exciting new industries on the horizon. And, you know, if you go to Stellenbosch or if you look at, you know, much of the VC world in South Africa, I think there's some interesting things happening. But those also aren't always easy businesses to bank, you know, to provide finance to. And often entrepreneurs are very good at identifying customers, identifying a niche in the market, at selling, but they're not particularly strong at the admin and the numbers, and then they blame the banks, or they blame kind of the lack of funding as the root cause of their issue. But in actual fact, you know, it's very difficult to fund a business if you can't get credible numbers which are well understood by the entrepreneur. They understand their margin, they understand their business, they understand their balance sheet. So I think that there might be a need for support for the entrepreneurs on kind of just basic financial management.
And a lot of them haven't necessarily studied that. I mean, this is not something that they understand. And then I would imagine for the bank, it's very, very difficult to deal with precisely what they want and to be able to give them what they want when you have no guarantees on your side that this is even a going concern very often. Sometimes it's just someone's idea.
Yeah, so we typically, you know, we'll support businesses that are post idea.
Right.
And, you know, we want to see the numbers and we'll go into the business. And that's part of, I think, our differentiation is we will.
Now, you mentioned differentiation. I mean, you've got lots of ideas of how to take, and the financial sector is transforming very fast. And you see a lot of innovation and differentiation technology coming in. Is this a threat or an opportunity, first of all?
Well, I think it's both. You know, I think it is a threat. I think that this fintech has become a buzzword in the global financial services industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I suppose where finances may be different to, say, taxis or hotel rooms or whatever else has been disrupted, is that the banks are very aware of it. So almost all the banks in South Africa have set up innovation hubs, they've set up fintech funds, they are investing in new technology, and we see it as a big opportunity. We're a bank without a lot of legacy and kind of a lot of the, you know, we quite specialized in what we offer, and so we've invested in a few fintechs ourselves. We invested in a robo advisor in the States, in Silicon Valley. We invested in a robo advisor in South Africa, which we just finalized the acquisition of. We've invested in a payment switch which enables kind of the lower end consumers to pay their municipal bills and their DSTV bills at a Shoprite or at a retailer. We're about to go live with an online lending platform, which we've invested in. And then we have also developed quite a few new things. You mentioned our Beyond kind of digital banking.
Tell me about that.
So back to kind of helping the entrepreneur. So we said we need to help the entrepreneur manage his money better. So one thing is accessing funding, but our banking platform gives the entrepreneur quite a bit of insight into his business.
Right.
We'll be going live any day now with a digital onboarding capability which could onboard a small business with multiple users, which I think is a first in the country, whereby if you're a small business and you've got maybe one or two directors, one or two shareholders, in terms of anti-money laundering, you have to onboard FICA, all of those individuals.
Sure.
We've kind of created a seamless process for that. A very simple, easy user face or interface for the entrepreneur. And then we can integrate into his accounting package. We can give him some basic payroll capabilities.
So it becomes this overview diagnostic tool.
Yeah, of his business.
That's terrific.
And something which kind of also helps with managing his cash flow. We give better interest rates on his cash.
Wow.
And it's a lower cost offering.
So, I mean, this would not have been possible when you started doing all of this
absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely. In the old days when we started, I mean, banks didn't even do leasing and factoring.
They and you had to have files and boxes and all kinds of things, right,
yes,
Roland?
Yes, yes.
I mean,
bookkeeping machines.
And this is terrific. I mean, in some ways, all of this information can be very intimidating, but actually it can now finally be put to use.
Oh, it is being put to use in a huge way. You know, it's mind-boggling to compare what goes on today with what went on in those days.
And does it give you insight into what kind of people your clients are and what kinds of businesses they have, which also then again helps you to predict things about the financial sector, the economy as a whole, whether or not things are looking healthy or less than healthy, and to then be able to decide your rates and so on based on those things.
So we never offered a bank account until a few years ago.
Mm.
So we were always a lender, and then we had our wealth management business, which is a separate business.
Right.
But really we were focused as a lender, but we were never kind of our client's primary bank. So we only offered up a bank account, we'll call it transactional internet banking, cards, etc., a couple of years ago. And now we have converted that transactional banking offering into a digital banking offering. And that kind of completely changes the analytics of your clients, of your client base. It enables you to take on more clients, but also to understand your clients' cash flows, because you actually have access to everything that's going on in your client's business.
Now, how important is it if you're in South Africa to comply with all the regulations, whether you are the lending institution or the business that needs to lend that money? Is it a very onerous process? Is it complicated?
It's hugely onerous. When we got our bank license, that was in 1999. I mean, if you compare, and so we're not talking about a huge amount of time, 20-odd years, mm-hmm. 20 years ago, say. That's when we got our bank license. It was a very simple process to even get the bank license. And you know, we had to have a 50 million rand capital in those days. And it was very simple. We put in our application. We got the license. Okay, it took about 6 months or so. And a lot of other banks also got their license. A lot of banks. I mean, there were about 30 licenses given in those couple of years up to that point. We were probably the last of the small bank licenses that were given. And then a lot of people gave back their licenses in the next couple of years. And the regulation has changed hugely from those days to what it is today. Because, of course, the meltdown happened with Lehman Brothers, and then the Basel bank rules came out, and then the FICA rules came out, which is another big thing because of the Twin Towers episode. So they decided, President Bush decided that they have to start this anti-money laundering. It was right. The idea was to go against terrorism, but then, of course, the tax authorities jumped on the bandwagon. They said, you know, why stop there?
Yeah, we can dig deeper.
So banks have to police their clients. We now are basically agents of the government to police our clients.
Yeah.
I mean, in the old days when we were doing finance, and this was applied to everybody, so I don't feel guilty in saying what I'm going to say, you'd go into a client's warehouse and he'd say to you, look, here's my balance sheet, but you see that whole rack of shelving over there with all those pieces of textiles on it? That's not in my balance sheet. So you add it to your balance sheet.
Is this off-balance sheet like what Steinhoff was doing?
So in those days, you know, everything was very casual and everybody, and you kind of take into account his non-disclosed assets. Yes. Now, if a client says that to you,
you've
got to
report
him, yeah. and he'll go to jail. And you'll go to jail if you don't report him. Jeez. So, you know, the world has changed completely.
But what about people who say that we largely survived almost unscathed in respect to that 2008 banking crisis because we are so well managed?
Most of the financial institutions follow their own rules, and they do follow them well. Always been pretty good compared to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. And, of course, we also had exchange control, which actually made it that much stronger. So we weren't involved in all those shenanigans going on in America and all over the world.
But I think what's important here is that as a banking regulator, you're looking for two things. One is you're looking for the stability of your banks, and we've got very stable banks. Okay, we've had a couple of issues in the last few weeks, politically, you know, charged to some degree with VBS and then you know, African Bank. But generally speaking, we've had a very stable banking sector over many years.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that a banking regulator or a kind of national treasury want to know is to what degree is your population banked, and to what degree is there competition, and to what degree is there easy access to finance. And I think there we have one of the lower levels, which is a huge concern. So, this is what they call twin peaks. You want to ensure that there's good market access and good access to financial services on the one hand, while retaining a very stable banking. And these things are in conflict with one another.
And then for you, does it represent, again, an opportunity? or is this something that's of great concern to you because so few people in South Africa are banked?
Well,
in terms of population numbers,
I think it is an opportunity, mm-hmm. I think that in the past, in order to bank the unbanked, you needed to have a huge brand, a huge balance sheet, and huge distribution. You had to have branches everywhere. Today, there's lots of arguments that you can bank the unbanked without those things.
Yeah.
If you create the right product set, delivered through the right, call it digitally enabled channels, across the country, then, you know, Uber had no brand, and they were able to access, you know, millions and millions of people through the right kind of packaging and delivery of their product. So I think that could be an opportunity. How we tap that is a whole separate question.
And obviously in the business world, something like Beyond will be terribly useful to people in terms of being able to figure out what the health of their business actually is, where the money's coming from, where it's going to, how to manage it better, how to grow your capital, how to attract investment if you need to do that, because the figures are all important when it comes to that too. So I congratulate you on that, because obviously it's a step in the right direction in terms of how this bank of yours evolves. And congratulations. I mean, Sasfin Wealth, Sasfin Capital, and now going into Beyond with an interface that allows people to manage their own money from wherever they are. It's terrific. You don't have to go into the bank manager anymore.
Right. That's right. No, thank you.
Well, congratulations, guys, and good luck with the launch. It sounds terrific. I'm just very, very interested in the story of how this whole business grew out of 1950s South Africa and how it's come to where it is now. It's a tremendous story.
Well, thank you very
one
much.
One you must
thank
be very so. Proud of.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah. Thank you. We are.
Yeah.
Thank you very
terrific
much.
Work. And okay. Congratulations to Roland and to Michael Sassoon. That's Sasfin. Now you wonder where the name comes from. Now you know. Right. A lot of people drive past the sign every day. They see your bank everywhere, and they're not sure exactly where it comes from. Family-owned bank. What a story. I love it. So whether you're a plumber, a doctor, an accountant, a craftswoman, a tailor, a fintech, a whiz kid, a musician, a magician, as long as you're working and building your business, Sasfin will work every day to create the tools that make it easier for you and your business to go beyond. Log on to sasfin.com or join up on Beyond. Give them a call on 0860 Sasfin, or you can speak to your accountant about joining them today. Sasfin, it's beyond a bank, and I think we've all learned that this morning. So thank you. Thanks very much, gents. Time for us to spend a bit of time with the CEO of Auto Trader, George Meany, who's brought in a couple of stories on Fridays. This is how we wrap things up. I love it. How are you, George?
Good on you, Gareth.
Great. Terrific. What have you got for us today?
Besides the tangled wires.
Oh, sorry. Pick your chair up. And
There we go. Almost there.
You're such a... At least you know how the studio works, you know. Sia and Mabale have been in here for years and they still get confused. Mind you, so do I. All right, what's happening? What's going on this week?
The Mercedes-Benz X-Class. I don't know if you know Mercedes-Benz brought out a Bucky.
What?
Yep, Bucky. That's what it looks like. It looks like a regular Ford Ranger.
It does, really. It's not very nice.
It's there's a bit of controversy around this X-Class Bucky, but it's here, and it's a German Bucky. So it should do well, because South Africans love German cars.
We love Buckies. What are you talking about?
Fueled by a 3-litre turbocharged V6 diesel motor. Don't know why there's a diesel in there, but
because it's a Bucky, man.
Because it's a Bucky, exactly. Going to retail between 642 and 791,000 rand for Bucky. So it should launch in May with four models in their lineup. I don't know. Mercedes-Benz Bucky. I don't know.
Maybe we should test it out.
Yeah. We will. We will.
You tell us what you think of it.
I will tell you what we think of it indeed. And then a controversial story. I don't know if you heard. Uber's self-driving test car had a crash.
Yeah, apparently they hit some passenger.
Yes. Well, a pedestrian. A person pushing a bicycle.
Pedestrian. Yeah. But, George, this is a very tiny mishap on the curve of improving the self-driving car. It obviously attracts a lot of controversy, and people are going to whine and whinge and complain about it. And we don't know whether this person jumped in front of the car. We don't know whether the car was out of control. There was apparently a driver at the wheel anyway. But now everybody gets hysterical, and the wheels grind to a halt.
Well, they found out a little bit more. It turns out that this Uber self-driving car had two cameras, one facing forward, one facing backwards, and recorded the entire incident.
Oh.
And it turns out that this 49-year-old Elaine Herzberg, who yes. died in hospital, yes. Stepped out of the shadows at the last possible second in the middle of the road. And not even the human that was at the wheel of the car, monitoring the car, saw what had happened.
But you see, we expect a car to be 100% right all
you
of
can't.
The time.
You absolutely can't. You can't. So nonetheless, I think it's kind of caused this initiative to take to slow down a little bit, because Uber, Toyota, Nissan, and Honda and Hyundai have all suspended their self-driving tests.
Oh God, result. Here we go. Hysteria kicks in.
So hopefully it'll pick up again, but for the moment everybody's frickin' panicking, and that's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And then on top of that, the UK has published a bill called the Automotive and Electric Vehicle Bill.
Yes.
Which is set to monitor and control the ordinary principles of negligence around self-driving cars. So it looks like the UK is actually ahead of the legal situation.
Most governments start making these laws about 20 years after they've started driving electric cars in those countries. So that's a progress of a kind.
It is kind of a progress of a kind. And then thirdly, the world's first 3D printed car is due on the roads in 2019. Looks like a bit of a bug.
It's horrible.
It is horrible.
It's one of those smart car type things.
It does look like a bit of a smart car called an LCEV. And there are only a few components on this car that's not 3D printed, which are the chassis, the glass windscreen, and the tires are made of conventional materials.
Wow, it's a 3D printed car.
3D printed car.
Now, there's some interesting stuff you didn't expect to hear this Friday morning. Imagine driving around in a car that someone's printed at home.
Exactly. And only goes for about £7,100.
Well, now we're talking.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this car is set to shake things up a little bit.
Are you going to drive one of those, George?
Well, if it comes to South Africa, I definitely will.
Of course you will.
Of course I will. Yeah.
You'd like to let us know.
Yeah. Right. I think it looks...
Can it even fit two people?
Looks like it. Don't know. Haven't seen the inside of it.
All right. It's cute.
Yeah, it's cute.
Don't know how well you'd do in an accident or if the roads get slippery, but it's cute.
It's very cute.
All right.
And then Honda is trying to make the world's fastest lawnmower.
Why?
Because they can, and because they've got the record from before. So they previously recorded 188 kilometers per hour 4 years ago on a lawnmower.
Okay, but does this thing actually cut the lawn at the same time?
It is reported to be able to cut lawn at 160 kilometers per hour.
That's phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
You could get your garden done in 2.5 minutes.
2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
So they're aiming for 215 kilometers per hour. Previous record's 188. This little lawnmower can do 0 to 100 kilometers per hour in 3 seconds. 3 seconds.
That's quite incredible. That's fast. That's faster than most of our cars.
Exactly. It's driven by a 1,000cc Honda motorbike engine.
Let it not be said that Auto Central and you and the rest of the team only pay attention to sports cars. You've got lawnmowers. You've got 3D printed cars. This is fantastic.
I absolutely love it. That's it. That's the news of the week, except for Formula One happening this weekend. And it's going to be extremely interesting because there's a lot of talk about Ferrari being the strongest. There's a lot of talk about Mercedes being the strongest. But I've got some news on the pit girls.
Oh, yes? What's
happened? They are being replaced by children on the pit lane. Oh. So they have recruited 40 children from Australia's auto sport sector, and they will be replacing the pit girls this weekend.
Oh, my God. All right, kids. There we go. So just in case you weren't bored with Formula One before, now you will be.
Cheers, Gareth.
Thank you, George. Don't miss Auto Central. It's on every Monday on cliffcentral.com. It's brought to you by Auto Trader, and that's George Meany, CEO, and one of the only people I know who can bring a lawnmower and a 3D printed car and the coolest in innovation, plus a Mercedes Bucky in. And that's just in 1 week. Yes, see. Tell you what. Just when you think you know everything, then that happens. All right. when it comes to innovation, Cliff Central's at the forefront of great technology. I've told you about this, but let me tell you again. We've created Cliff Central's unwired earphones. Actually, a message from somebody this morning about this. Let me read this to you quickly, because this is very cool. Just got my Cliff Central unwired earphones. They've been amazing. Not only do they match up with the more expensive competition, in some ways they blow the competition out of the water. This is from Mash. The headsets are so loud and clear that I can hear the sounds of a keyboard typing in the background there when Ben is sitting opposite you. Mash. Yeah, but that's because Ben types like a gorilla. But there we go. Thank you very much, Mash. That's an endorsement right there. Don't take our word for it. Stuff Magazine wrote, if you're a podcast fan, you should have a pair already and perhaps a spare in the car based on the price alone. The Cliff Central unwired earphones connect to any smartphone, laptop, or tablet for listening to podcasts, music, videos, and even phone calls. With over 10 hours of battery life, built-in microphone, 3-button controller, and an ergonomic design so it doesn't fall out of your ears when you're exercising, plus brilliant sound and build quality, the Cliff Central unwired earphones are the perfect match to your perfect podcasts. Best of all, they're only 550 Rand. Discover more by visiting cliffcentral.com. All right, you want the unnews? Here we go. Let's check in on those stories and then wrap it up for the morning. Here are the things you need to know. Mark Zuckerberg has had a tough week and he's decided to have a few drinks on Wednesday night. He woke up so hungover the next day he rushed to work and forgot to put his human mask on. People ran for their lives, but Facebook management were quick to say it was just a publicity stunt for a new sci-fi movie they've invested in. Jacob Zuma believes his legal fees should be paid by you, a taxpayer, and all his so-called crimes were done as part of his job of being president. He's still so perplexed that people don't understand what politics is about. It's all about being a criminal, and that's how he became president after all. And finally, the Australians have been forced to clean up their acts on the field when it comes to sledging against the Proteas, but this hasn't limited the evil of these cricketers. The stump microphones yesterday picked up that Steve Smith and his men were taunting the Protea batsmen by saying that they'd taken baths all week in Cape Town, and that they'd left the tap running in their change room since the start of play on day one. What dreadful people. Just to wrap it up, in case you've got nothing on next week and you want to join us at the Five Fingers for Marseille, you need to email events@cliffcentral.com. It was premiered at last year's Toronto Film Festival. It's been described as a must-see masterwork, visually stunning and captivating. You don't want to miss this. Plus, we might even have one of the stars there. That's right. That's Five Fingers for Marseille. Make sure you go to events@cliffcentral.com on the email and book your place today. Thanks for joining us. We will see you on Monday. Have an excellent weekend. Be good. Cliffcentral.com here to look after you through the course of the day with a bunch of brilliant programs, all for your listening pleasure.
This is cliffcentral.com.